is basically theory two, unit 11, part one, diabetes. So two sort of main classifications of diabetic patients, well, three, so to speak. But two, there are two classifications of medical emergencies you're gonna deal with in diabetic patients. Number one, the most common by far is the insulin-dependent diabetic who is hypoglycemic, so low blood sugar. Number two, very, very rarely, is the insulin-dependent diabetic who is hyperglycemic and has a diabetic ketoacidosis. The third is just the NIDDM patients, the non-insulin-dependent diabetic mellitus patients. And they rarely go hypoglycemic, and they rarely go hyperglycemic. And when they go hyperglycemic, they don't develop a ketoacidosis. We'll talk about that later. So the big one we see most often is the insulin-dependent diabetics who go hypoglycemic. Those are great calls because they're unconscious. We start an IV, we give them sugar intravenously, and they wake up. It's like a miracle. It's beautiful. It's the best thing ever. So, all right. You're wondering what that is?
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. We'll come to it later. All right, so major endocrine glands include the hypothalamus. We're really gonna talk about the pancreas for now, but the hypothalamus is an endocrine gland, the pituitary gland, the thyroid, the parathyroid, the thymus, the pancreas, which we're gonna talk about now, the adrenals, and the ovaries and the testes. So the pancreas produces two main hormones. It produces insulin. And insulin lowers blood sugar levels, moves glucose into the cell. Right. So it's like a messenger that has a key to let sugar into the cell. Think of it that way. Glucagon, which is another hormone produced by the pancreas, is secreted by the alpha cells in the pancreas. Anyone know where the insulin is produced? What cells in the pancreas? It's called the islets of Langerhans. The islets of Langerhans. Which would be a great name for a pub, I think. We'll come to that in a second. So glucagon is produced and secreted by the alpha cells in the pancreas. I should go back to insulin. Insulin is produced by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. Insulin is produced by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. Insulin is produced by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. Glucagon is produced by the alpha cells, not in the islets of Langerhans. At least I don't think so. So glucagon raises blood sugar levels by breaking down glycogen stores, right? What glucose we don't use, we store into glycogen. Eventually that may become fat. So glycogen is stored primarily in the liver and skeletal muscles. And the other one hormone produced by the pancreas is somatostatin. And somatostatin lowers insulin or glucagon levels when those hormone levels are too high. So that's the role of somatostatin. Okay? The pancreas also produces digestive enzyme. That's its exocrine function. So insulin. Again, comes from the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. Glucagon comes from the alpha cells, and somatostatin comes from the delta cells. You okay, Phil? You're looking at me like...
Okay.
You good? Okay. So glucose is normally between 4 to 6 millimoles per liter. So when you use a glucometer, that's what we tested in. Americans use... something in deciliters, I think. It's a much higher number. It's like 120 is a normal blood sugar in the old imperial system. And glucose may be anywhere from 3 to 6 millimoles per liter in children under 2, so lower level. We treat adult patients or teenagers for blood sugars less than 4 with infants under 3, basically. We'll talk about that in a second. So blood sugars are typically high when you have a fight or flight response. So if you get someone in a car crash who's got an altered mental status and you're thinking, well, it could be a head injury, but I got to check blood sugar anyway because they've got altered mental status, don't be at all surprised. Someone in a crash has a blood sugar of 10, 12, 13. That's a normal response. That's a catecholamine response, right? We're dumping epinephrine and norepinephrine, which is our catecholamines, and you break down sugars from your glycogen stores for that fight or flight response. That's normal. So trauma, patients who've had a seizure, someone who's febrile, immediately after a meal, of course. So diabetes, so insulin is produced by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans and the pancreas, and the islets make up about 5% of the pancreas, pretty small amount. And for whatever reason, diabetes is a type 1 diabetes, the insulin dependent diabetes is an autoimmune disorder, meaning for reasons that are not terribly clear, our immune system starts attacking the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans and kills them off, and they stop producing insulin. Hopefully within your lifetime, we'll see stem cell therapy to regenerate beta cells. So diabetes is marked by an inadequate insulin production, and in type 2 diabetes especially, also a cellular resistance to insulin, so you can have both. And insulin is needed to regulate blood sugar levels, and it's a dominant hormone when blood sugar is high, right? Transports glucose into the cell or makes the cell permeable to glucose. So, and it also converts excess glucose to glycogen. So type 1 diabetes, this an autoimmune disorder, as I mentioned, it's an absolute or relative deficiency of insulin, early onset, typically average age 14. So when you have kids, or if you have kids, you'll probably be like me, as a paramedic, you start looking for your kid to pass certain landmarks, you know, like when's my kid gonna get croup? Is my kid gonna be diabetic? You know, she's 17 now, hopefully she's out of the woods in that respect. But you always worry that something's gonna come along, right, and do harm to the child you love and you don't wanna see anything happen to. So it's an estimated 3 children out of every 1,000, so numbers are fairly small, but in some respects high, that develop insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus by age 20. Also referred to as juvenile onset diabetes, most children with diabetes have IDDM and a lifetime dependence on exogenous insulin. So they got to take insulin injections, right? So that's IDDM. Type 2 is later onset. And so they may have partial destruction of the insulin-producing islet cells and or cells that are have a reduced response to insulin. And sometimes referred to as age onset diabetes, typically NIDDM, typically non-NIDDM. What was I getting at here? So NIDDMs are much more common. We see a lot of NIDDMs. Almost every patient you encounter over 60 is NIDDM. Well, I shouldn't say almost everyone, but probably close to 40%. It's a very high number. And higher in certain ethnicities, certain communities. Significantly more common than type 1. There's a certain genetic predisposition, so it's not just lifestyle, it's predominantly a genetic predisposition, but obesity is certainly a precipitating factor. And people with type 2 diabetes usually start with diet and oral hypoglycemic drugs, drugs that reduce their blood glucose level, but they may progress to the point where they need insulin. And my brother-in-law is actually going through a randomized control trial where they're giving him, they put him through this pretty rigorous process involving insulin for his type 2 diabetes, but the hope of the trial is, the outcome is that he will no longer need insulin and not even need oral medications. It's apparently supposed to reverse type 2 diabetes, but we'll find out at some point. So long-term complications with diabetics, especially IDDMs, but type 2s as well. Retinopathies, so problems with the eyes, cataracts, hypertension, progressive renal failure, early coronary artery disease, peripheral vascular disease. Neuropathies, so neuropathies are like alteration in pain sensation, either loss of pain sensation, numbness and tingling in the periphery, sometimes a pain in the periphery that requires medication to manage the pain. So peripheral neuropathies can be a variety of different things. An increased risk of infection. What else? So let's talk about hypoglycemia. So hypoglycemia is the most common medical emergency that we see in insulin-dependent diabetics. And so they take insulin, they eat, they exercise, they try to regulate their lifestyle and their insulin intake and their food intake to maintain a steady blood sugar. But sometimes their blood sugar gets low because they've maybe taken insulin without eating, or they took insulin they meant to eat but they didn't get a chance to eat for whatever reason, they become hypoglycemic, or they maybe took too much insulin by mistake. So there are lots of different reasons why they become hypoglycemic. So hypoglycemia, in contrast with hyperglycemia, hypoglycemia has an acute onset. It happens fairly suddenly, like within minutes to a half an hour or so, because they took too much insulin, or they didn't take enough food in, or they exercise without taking enough food in, or on rare occasions, I've only seen like two or three type 2 diabetics who become hypoglycemic, and it's almost always because they recently started on an antibiotic, and the antibiotic is metabolized by the cytochrome P450 system in the liver. And I'm mentioning that not to freak you out, but it's a system you're going to discuss in pharmacology in third semester, so I'm just prepping you for it. So a lot of drugs are metabolized by the cytochrome P450 system, including diabetic drugs and including antibiotics. And so if you're a type 2 diabetic and you go on an antibiotic, there's a risk that you're drug that lowers your blood sugar may not get metabolized as quickly, so there may be more of it in your system, and that may cause a low blood sugar if it's not getting broken down. So hypoglycemia in IDDMs is by far the most common diabetic emergency encountered by paramedics. So the clinical presentation, when you get a low blood sugar, they typically get a fight or flight response. They get clammy, so they get diaphoretic, they get pale, they may develop confusion, agitation, they may drop down their GCS and become comatose, and have GCSs anywhere in the range from 3 to 14. General weakness, diaphoresis, blood glucose in adults less than 4 millimoles per liter. What does your directive say about children under 2? Why don't you take a look at your directive and tell me. So kids under 2, less than 3 millimoles per liter. Because neonates are the only subgroup of patients who can experience hypoglycemia without diabetes. So you get a newborn, right? The idea is to warm them, dry them, warm them, keep them warm. And if they're wet and they're cold, they burn off their brown fat and they become hypoglycemic, even though they're not diabetic. So newborns are the only subcategory of patients who can become hypoglycemic without diabetes. So you got to watch. When you, in a year from now, when you get hired by a paramedic service and you go for your base hospital testing, one of the things they love to do is see if you take a blood sugar in a baby who's got an altered mental status, or the parents telling you the kid is more lethargic than usual, or I don't know what's going on with this kid, he's restless, or he's lethargic, or he sleeps all the time, or you know, he's got this faint cry. Take a blood sugar. Just take a blood sugar, right, and see if they're hypoglycemic, and then treat it. So the differential diagnosis for hypoglycemia. So they typically present as I just described, but there are other patients that present similarly, and they include, of course, number one, hypoglycemia. Alcohol intoxication, that's ETOH intoxication. Stroke can present like a diabetic. In fact, you can have hypoglycemia and have left-sided weakness or right-sided weakness. You can present just like a stroke with hypoglycemia, and then you check the blood sugar, you correct their blood sugar, and boom, no more stroke. They just appeared like they were having a stroke. CNS infection, postictal, so a patient who's had a seizure, dehydration, hypothyroidism, renal failure, hepatic failure, psychosis. So the key is any altered level of awareness or mental status, check a blood sugar. Less than 4 in adults, give them sugar. Less than 3 under the age of 2, give them sugar. So management, so you've got a couple of choices. Ideally, you want to start an IV and give dextrose and water, D50. Alternatively, we give them glucagon, so manage the airway. If you're managing the airway because they're unconscious, just remember that if you put an OPA in, once you reverse their hypoglycemia, that OPA is going to come out quickly because they're going to gag on it and choke on it, and you want to pull it out, right? So you might want to manage them without an OPA if you've got a reversible cause of unconsciousness. And the usual SpO2, O2, assess blood glucose levels, ECG, IV access, D50. D50 is the best treatment of choice. It's quick. It's actually a lot cheaper than glucagon. Glucagon's about $140, $180 a dose. Yeah, I know. Dextrose and water, I think it costs maybe $4, $6. The IV tubing, less than $12. It's so much cheaper and much quicker, much more efficient to give D50 or glucagon IM. So your directives for dextrose, if they're over 2, glucagon, no age. Dextrose, the other reason you might not give glucagon is if they have something called pheochromocytoma, which is a rare adrenal tumor, because giving glucagon to someone with pheochromocytoma can stimulate the tumor to cause excess catecholamine release. Now, in all my years, I've never seen a pheochromocytoma, but I know a paramedic crew that had a pheochromocytoma. It was an interesting case. And their patient was hypoglycemic, and they didn't give glucagon because they had pheochromocytoma, or the wife said, my husband's being investigated for pheochromocytoma. But I'll just tell you, if you've got a tumor on your adrenal gland that's causing secretion of catecholamines like epinephrine and norepinephrine, typically with pheochromocytoma, they have labile vital signs, meaning their blood pressure goes up, their heart rate goes up, and then it comes back down. When the heart rate goes up and their blood pressure goes up, their face goes flush. So they really feel like crap. And this can go on for days and weeks. And you know, if they have pheochromocytoma and they're not diabetic, they're probably more likely to get a high blood sugar rather than a low blood sugar. Like hypoglycemia would be, this has been going on for a while now, and they depleted their glucose stores. If you encounter someone with a pheochromocytoma, do not give glucagon. It's contraindicated. It could be fatal for them because glucagon stimulates that tumor to cause more release of catecholamines, right? We want to save people, to help people, not kill them. Okay? So it's not a benign drug. We do not give glucagon to pheochromocytoma patients. Okay. The dosages, so if they're 2 years of age or older and they're getting D50, we give 0.5 grams per kilogram. So D50, whenever you see a percentage solution, it's always the number of grams in, it's a reflection of the number of grams in 100 mLs. So in other words, D50W, dextrose, 50% water equals 50 grams in 100 mLs. Now the preload is only 50 mLs. So the preload of D50 is only 50 mLs. So how many grams would you be giving a patient if you're giving them a full preload? Preload means the drug's mixed in the syringe already to go. If it's only 50 mLs, how many grams are you giving them? Would you say 25? Yeah, 25, exactly. Pretty simple math. So if you're giving them, you know, 25 kilos or more, then, 25 kilos or more, then you're going to give them 25 grams. if they're less than 25 kilos with D50, you're going to give them 0.5 grams per kilo or 1 ml per kilo. Now, when you document the dose on your EPCR, you document the actual quantity, not quantity, but you document the actual number of grams you gave. So if you have a 20 kilogram child and you give them 20, it's a mil per kilo, and you give them 20 mLs, how many grams would that be? Think about this. This is 50 grams and 100 mLs. Half of that is 25 grams. So think half of this. How many grams? 10 grams? 10 grams. Yeah, 10 grams. Yeah, so you would say, 10 grams dextrose IV. That's it. Sometimes I see medics who write, 1 ml per kilo is what we gave. Well, that's not a dose. Like the base hospital physician wants to know that the medic was able to make the calculation and determine like how many grams or milligrams of a drug was given, not how many mLs. ML is just a volume, right? You know what I mean? Make sense? Okay, good. Glucagon. So glucagon, if they're under 25 kilos, they get 0.5 milligrams intramuscular. And if they're 25 kilos or more, which is the vast majority of patients we see, then they get 1 gram. It comes in a concentration of 1 gram per ml, so they get an ml intramuscular, or half an ml intramuscular if they're under 25 kilograms. Pretty straightforward, right? Now glucagon, just for fun, also relaxes the gastrointestinal system, the GI tract. They use glucagon quite a bit in the OR for abdominal surgery, and it'll relax the esophagus as well. And on extremely rare occasions, if a child swallows, for example, a large gumball, and it gets stuck in the esophagus and actually occludes the airway because it's compressing the posterior wall of the trachea, they'll give high-dose intravenous glucagon to relax the esophagus, to let that gumball drop through. I know of only one paramedic who's called a physician to get an order for glucagon, and apparently it worked, and the gumball went down. So whether the gumball actually went down on its own or whether it's a glucagon remains a mystery, but I know of only one paramedic who's ever patched for an order for glucagon. And typically, the dose would be 3 milligrams to 8 milligrams in a child intravenously. So it would have to be given by an ACP. The other time that glucagon is sometimes used, just for fun, and it would be the only the ACP who could do this, is it's given IV in high doses, 8 to 10 milligrams, for a calcium channel blocker overdose. And the reason for that is that in a calcium channel blocker overdose, the heart will become a really weak muscle. Without calcium, the heart doesn't pump effectively. And glucagon actually stimulates the force of cardiac contractility through not the beta receptors in the heart, but through what they call secondary messenger system, which you'll learn about in pharmacology in third semester. So glucagon we give most often for hypoglycemia in IDDM patients. On extremely rare occasions, ACPs may be able to give it to a choking victim when there's an obstruction in the esophagus blocking the posterior wall of the trachea. And the third case is glucagon in high dose IV by ACPs for a calcium channel blocker overdose. Now you know everything there is to know about glucagon. It's pretty cool stuff. So clinical considerations: if the patient responds to dextrose or glucagon, he or she may receive oral glucose, so tablets, or simple carbohydrates, you know, drink of orange juice or something. If only mild signs and symptoms are exhibited, the patient can receive oral glucose tablets or simple carbohydrates instead of dextrose or glucagon. So if they're awake and talking and they're just pale and clammy, but you know, they're understanding what I'm saying to them, I just give them some juice or something. Has Randy put a call out for volunteers for the powwow, upcoming powwow? Oh, was it last weekend? Okay, did any of you volunteer for it? No one volunteered for it?
I don't think she put.
What's that? No, nothing went out? Okay, maybe they just didn't request it this year. Anyway, there's a high incidence of diabetes in our indigenous population, and so we often get calls at the powwow for people who just need some juice and something to eat. If a patient initiates an informed refusal of transport, you need his final set of vital signs, you need to get a final glucose, and it's got to be documented, and you want to make sure that the patient eats something before you leave. So I'll always have someone make a sandwich. There's got to be a responsible adult with them before you leave them. So pheochromocytoma, as I mentioned, is a rare catecholamine-secreting tumor in the adrenal gland. It occurs in about 0.05 to 0.2% of hypertensive individuals. Clinical presentation, their vital signs can be labeled. As I said, blood pressure, heart rates go up, and then they come down, and they go up, and they come down. They have weight loss, they have constipation, they have flank pain, they have epigastric pain, they have a sense of doom. Right? Because imagine your heart starts racing and your blood pressure goes up. You feel like, what is going on with me? Some people may attribute it to anxiety or maybe a pheochromocytoma. Right? Rarely do they go hypoglycemic, they usually go hyperglycemic. So glucagon is contraindicated, maybe worse than hypoglycemia, might kill them, not good. Insulinoma, it's not even mentioned in your medical directive, but that's a neuroendocrine tumor. From the pancreas islet cells can produce excess amounts of insulin. So they may become hypoglycemic. And the best treatment for them is, rather than glucagon, is to treat them with D50, quite simply put. So let's just leave that there. So here, some questions for you. Who discovered insulin?
Banting.
That's right, Sir Frederick Banting. Total jump, eh? Good. And where was Sir Frederick Banting born? Alliston. Yay! Hence the first slide. That's it. Any questions about hypoglycemia? We just burned through that one, eh? You guys okay, or you're on cerebral overload? Yeah. Yeah, she says she's on her phone the entire time. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
You just
first.
Look,